Welcome, everyone, to the series premiere of Only Murders in the Writer's Room. I will be your host, Denny Piach. And first off, just a little warning, much like a majority of the shows and movies I plan to dive into, the following, as most TV channels would say, is only for mature audiences, so viewer discretion is advised. Anywho, in this series, we're going to be analyzing how a show or movie was executed. Then I'll give my thoughts of how I believe it could have been done better. Sometimes I'll change and mix up plot points, plot devices, or plots in general. Other times I'll just scrap an ending entirely and come up with a completely different one from, well, imaginary scratch. And then finally, I'll leave it up to you guys, the audience, if you agree, disagree, or better yet, if you'd like, tell me your own fan-made ending. I really want to hear what you guys think of the stories, how you would have executed it, if you would have executed it, and any other similar thoughts you might have. Now, our first few analyses, and God help me, that word is so hard to pronounce, much like murders and murderers, like the difference, you know, to differentiate. Oh, man. Anyways, our first few analyses, which are connected in a certain way, are going to be Hulu's original series, Only Murders in the Building, HBO Max's only original series, The Flight Attendant, and Paramount's original movie, Young Sherlock Holmes. Oh, and also Lionsgate original movie, Knives Out. When I finished watching the first season of Only Murders in the Building, or as I call it, OMITBA for short, you know, OMITB, I found myself a little underwhelmed. I mean, the show is intriguing, don't get me wrong. However, I noticed that something slowly has become a trend in recent mysteries. There always is a second mystery that really does not need to be in the story for any particular reason. Spoiler alert for anyone who has not seen, is in the midst of seeing, or does not wish to hear about OMITBA, The Flight Attendant, Young Sherlock Holmes, Knives Out, or Bullet Train, but that movie's referenced lightly, very lightly, microscopically even. It's recapping time. The two mysteries in OMITBA are two deaths, one that takes place in the past, another that takes place in the present. The three main characters that are trying to solve both are Mabel, played by Selena Gomez, Oliver, played by Martin Short, and Charles, played by Steve Martin. For a majority of the series, I thought the three were going to reveal both deaths were connected somehow. The first death was a girl named Zoe Cassidy, played by Olivia Reese, who was a close friend of Mabel's. The second death was another close friend of Mabel's, Tim Kono, played by Julian Tsihi. Unfortunately, the seventh episode of the first season, titled The Boy from 6B, revealed Zoe's death to be an accident, on a technicality level, although. She was arguing with a deaf character named Theo, played by James Caverly, who was actually in real life, fun fact, deaf. Hey guys, I mentioned later in the episode my Instagram account, and it's spelled DENI.PIVAC. And anyways, so they're arguing on the rooftop of the building where all the main characters just so happen to reside, the Arconia. The Arconia, it's like a character of its own that needs to be given its own spinoff. Because, like, the building, when I first saw it, looks classical and yet modern at the same time. And fun fact, though it is fictional, it was inspired by an actual Upper West Side apartment building, the Bell Nord, which eventually convinced me this series is more clever than I gave them credit for. And also, fun fact about the Bell Nord, it eventually got so bad, the maintenance, I mean, got so bad that everyone evacuated and left the building to rot, and now it's become a complete jungle. Now, the floor design of the courtyard of Arconia is like a magnet, and rightfully so, because something about the building just wants to, you know, pull you in, and it's like, I don't know, it's just like magical, you know. But I'm sorry if I may be rambling a little bit too much, but if a freaking Fiji water bottle can be considered a titular character in the movie Bullet Train, I see no reason why an apartment building can't be given similar treatment. And yes, that is the only time I will reference Bullet Train. Promise. Scout's honor. Anyways, Theo tries to confront Zoe, but Zoe pulls away too hard, causing her to fall off the rooftop and plummet to her death. As for Tim Kono, the season finale titled Open and Shut reveals that Tim started to get depressed after parting ways with Mabel due to the death of Zoe. Eventually, he bumped into a resident of the building, Jane Bellows, and the two started dating. Jane killed Tim when she mistakenly believed he was having an affair with another woman. Why did she mistakenly believe that? Because Tim was trying to get Theo and his father, Teddy arrested since they turn out to be funeral home grave robbers. One night, long before Zoe's death, Theo left a ring for Mona's grave robberies in his apartment. On that same night, Mabel, Tim, Zoe, and another friend, Oscar, played by Aaron Dominguez, break into Theo's apartment for fun. Zoe steals the ring, and later on, Theo asks for it back. That's when the argument ensues, Zoe falls to her death, and Tim witnesses Zoe's death. Years later, Tim manages to retrieve the ring through a black market and believes he can put away Theo and Teddy, played by Nathan Lane, forgot to mention that, for good. Unfortunately, Jane discovers the ring and believes Tim is going to propose to someone else, or at least was having an affair with someone else. She kills Tim, and like that, I realize something. If Teddy did not become a grave robber, the whole show would have never happened. Like a row of dominoes, it just takes that one MacGuffin, that one singular plot device to decide the fate of the rest. However, that was not what particularly disappointed me. What particularly disappointed me was how a lot of the seemingly clear became unclear. I mean, why was it important for Theo and Teddy to get arrested? It's not like the main focus of the season was about them, but rather the death of Tim Kono. I mean, they even bring back the pair for the second season, then make them suspects yet again, even though they are far from it, and then try to redeem them, both characters. Now, that is not to say I did not enjoy seeing them. Nathan Lane gave an incredible performance, portraying Theo's very passionate but menacing father, Teddy. Although, I actually would have preferred if Teddy and Theo were good guys. They could have helped Mabel and Oliver, and they could have helped Mabel, Oliver, and Charles along the way. You know, maybe solving some mystery in season 2, of course. But due to the direction of the series, the only outcome I could see worked in is if Teddy and or Theo returned and became true villains. I mean, Teddy even warned Oliver in the second season that he will have his revenge for how Oliver and his friends ruined his life. Though that is not exactly how he phrased it, it's best to keep this show hovering over the PG-13 rating like a good guardian angel. As for Charles, he's the mystery's link by chance. Further into the season, he decides to start dating again. Though an enthusiastic banjo player, he sparks the attention of a neighboring bassoonist while playing the accordion. At first, Charles is nervous dating someone younger than him, but the woman reassures him she's done the same. Mabel and Oliver eventually stumble upon the woman's bassooning gear, cleaning equipment, extra pieces, etc., and discover she carries a tool that Tim had at his place. Unfortunately, the two put together that the woman Charles is seeing is the same woman that killed Tim Kono. That's right, it's Jan. Though I could pick at numerous MacGuffins within the show, it would be pointless considering many stories utilize MacGuffins to keep it going, to keep things interesting, and to keep things, well, original. However, I really just can't help but wonder how many musicians and or musician enthusiasts watched the show and solved Tim's murder sooner than the main characters when they saw Tim kept a bassoon cleaner. Like, that is one thing I would change, but not a big thing, just one minor thing. But speaking of change, it's time to change the execution. For this segment, I want to go over each and every episode and change each and every aspect. I'm not going to go over each and every episode and change each and every aspect. Instead, I'm just going to go over a few major aspects of the series. Let's go. Number one, the killer. Though Zoe's death was technically an accident, Tim did not see it that way. He was nearly going to tell the police about Theo, which would eventually incarcerate his father. But thanks to the cruel old-fashioned death-threatening, he did not. I would have loved to see an episode where we are showed how Tim is handling things present day. Maybe halfway during the episode he breaks down because he realizes just how many lives he truly destroyed. Mabel was not only a friend, but a lover. Zoe was not an acquaintance, she was more like a sister. And Oscar was also not just an acquaintance, but a brother. I believe diving deeper into Tim's psyche would make him an even more relatable, or at best, sympathetic character. Eventually in the season, it would have been revealed that Tim snapped and decided to blab about Teddy and Theo. Teddy would have found out and stopped Tim, since the second season of Amitba reveals there are secret passages within the walls of the Arconia. Teddy then murders Tim, makes it look like an accident, and then Mabel, Oliver, and Charles solve it like it was. I understand that the creators and writers were trying to connect each and every little thing. I mean, the only reason Charles plays a big role in the first season is because he's dating an axe murderer. Technically, Jane's a poisoner, but I just wanted to squeeze in one Mike Myers reference for fun. However, Charles was already an interesting character. He didn't have to be connected by others to make sense of his purpose. Heck, in the second season, the show went to ridiculously and hilariously extreme levels with that, but they owned it. Essentially a so-bad-it's-good kind of vibe. On to my second critical change, the deaths. Though it was impactfully tragic when Zoe died, I didn't like exactly how she died. I mean, slipping off the ledge, that just seemed like an easier way to get Tim involved with Theo and Teddy's business, and for Theo, did not seem like such a bad guy. Though I found a majority of the characters charmingly likable, Nathan Lane is known as a typecast for many of those said characters. However, I wanted to see that innocently polite man transform into a passionately menacing business tycoon. As seen in the series, Teddy's known for getting what he wants, however he wants. Mabel also mentions, during a narration, that Zoe and her family were filthy rich. They owned the entire 11th floor, the Arconia, I think, and maybe Teddy started feeling insecure and wanted to gain more power, more authority. The only way he could was if if the competition were eliminated. This is what I think could happen. Teddy utilizes Arconia's secret passageways. He enters Zoe's family's apartment and turns on the gas. Fortunately, Zoe's out role-playing Hardy Boy mysteries with Mabel, Tim, and Oscar, which was also revealed and devised in the original first season. However, the only two people in the apartment are Zoe's mother and father, but they are sleeping. They die from gas poisoning, and a funeral is held at the same funeral home where Teddy and Theo perform their grave robberies. During the wake, Zoe notices Theo going into the back of the funeral home, and Zoe discovers what he truly does for a living. Well, technically the unliving, I guess. Anyways, Zoe and Theo get into an argument, and then Teddy knocks Zoe out. With the help of Theo, Teddy makes it look like Zoe's death, for lack of a less harsher word, was self-inflicted. Since the time between Zoe's death and Tim's death is nearly a decade, I really would like to know that Mabel, Oscar, and Tim didn't just sit around, but became actual Hardy Boys and tried to solve the murder of Zoe's family for a few good years. Maybe they had a dispute and parted ways, but something pulled Tim back into the game. Maybe he eventually got too close and, I don't know, was killed by Teddy. I'm like just spitting ball here. But once Mabel and Oscar reconcile, maybe they could team up with Charles and Oliver. The four would eventually discover the secret passageways and some unusual goop that trails a few of them. Oliver realizes that the goop is actually Greek dip, and the only person he knows in the entire building who has an array of Greek dips is Teddy. They sneak into Teddy's new apartment, and Oscar finds an amulet he gave to Zoe to proclaim his love to her atop Teddy's fireplace. It disappeared sometime between the wake and Zoe's death. This not only confirms that Teddy was the last to have confronted Zoe, but also that Theo knew about it. Mabel and Oscar are left heartbroken and don't hook up with each other, unlike the show devise. Oliver and Charles decide to end the podcast, and... oh my god, wait a second. I forgot actually about the infamous opening scene of the series premiere. Hang on, so let's trace it back a little bit. So, we are first introduced to Charles and Oliver and Mabel when the two gentlemen are running down the stairs and yelling frantically. They burst into an apartment, later revealed to be Mabel's, and discover Mabel, her shirt covered with blood, is kneeling over a dead body. Though that was a tease for season 2, it really didn't make any sense to have it at the beginning of the first season if it was never going to be revealed later on in said season. Instead, the teasing opening could have been Charles, Oliver, Mabel, and Oscar discovering the secret passageways with Oliver shouting, "What the f-?" And then it cuts to a black screen with a white lettered title card reading 3 months earlier. Exciting, right? As for the second season, the only similar thing I would change is the killer. Fictionally famous podcaster Cinda Canning, played by Tina Fey, was suspected of being it, but it turns out her assistant, Poppy White, played by Adina Verson, was the true culprit. Her boyfriend, Detective Krebs, played by Michael Rapaport, assisted her. I would have preferred Cinda over Poppy because a past name could have been revived. Similarly to Teddy's, someone who craves something so badly, i.e. to have a famous podcast, they would do anything to get it. I mean, to think Cinda would actually kill, create a mystery, and then to solve said mystery on her own, you know, murder mystery, is unbelievable. Though Poppy's reasoning was somewhat similar, I doubt she would have gone anywhere considering how badly Cinda treated her. But What do you, the fans, think? Only Murder fans, of course, think. Should Teddy and Theo have never become villains in the first place? Should Jan still be a villain for a future season? If you'd like, you can express your thoughts through my Instagram, denny.pivac. It's spelled like that, but it's pronounced Pivac. I know it's confusing. With all that said about Omidba, we move on to The Flight Attendant. The HBO Max original series stars Kaley Cuoco as the title character, somewhat. Though her actual name is Cassandra Cassie Bowden, she does work as a flight attendant. Now, the first season is all right, but to understand my frustration with the second season, a recap must be put in order. In the first season, Cassie is working on a flight to Bangkok. She meets a charmingly likable passenger, the two become flirtatious, and then it becomes more intimate. The day after they meet, Cassie wakes up from a hangover and discovers the gentleman's bloodily mangled corpse. It's later revealed in the season that the man, named Alex, played by Mikael Huisman, kept a book hidden with information about clients of his who he was trying to protect from the same man that killed him. That same man that killed him, named Buckley, played by Colin Woodell, eventually dated Cassie without her knowing of his true intentions, of course. Fortunately, Cassie meets up with an acquaintance of Buckley's named Miranda, played by Michelle Gomez, and the two team up, Cassie and Miranda, to take Buckley down. Though I will not constantly gush over each and every actress or actor I mention, I couldn't help but gush over Michelle Gomez's appearance. And I know that's not a typical word used by Gen Z, but I literally gushed when I saw her. I mean, the first time I heard her during a voiceover in the series, I instantly recognized her immediately and was like, "Oh my god, it's Missy!" If some of you didn't understand my reaction completely, don't worry. Only Whovians could get that reference. Anyways, I found the addition of Miranda entertaining because, like Michelle's other characters, she can be charmingly sweet and menacingly strict. Sometimes even a pinch of both. Now that I think about it, there's a second mystery in the first season, but it stretches on to the second season. So, technically, there are three mysteries in the second season. The first mystery being, prove Cassie's innocence. After becoming an asset for the CIA, Cassie is immediately framed with murders and compromising countless missions. With the help of her two best friends, Annie Max, played by Zoisia Mamet and Denise Akadeniz, a couple in the show who I could also gush over but would take too much time, they manage to discover someone on the inside is setting Cassie up. Now the third mystery, whose spot I switch with the second mystery, is proving Megan's innocence. Though Megan is another friend of Cassie's, I felt Rosie Perez's portrayal of the character was more like an older sister that Cassie never had. Even though she was dealing with problems of her own, she was always available to help others, especially Cassie, and that's like just so sweet. As for Megan's problems, she got entangled with corporate espionage between the North Korean government and her husband's workplace. Though technically one could say Megan's mystery is really an arc, and it did come full circle by the end of season 2, I still not see the point of introducing said story if it was not going to be a main focus of the series, and that's another trend I noticed too with other shows. Nowadays, episodes can only be really short. For example, cartoons like Teen Titans Go being only 11 minutes, or some shows can have to be extremely long. For example, the fourth season finale of Stranger Things is nearly the runtime of the average movie, like any average movie. Now, I can understand if The Flight Attendant had standards or deadlines to meet, i.e. each episode being an hour long, but I would not have minded if the episodes were shorter. If anything, that would have made me crave more for the episodes to be longer. Plus, each episode, if they were split, the amount of episodes would be the average amount of any primetime show. But I digress. To digress, some more about the third and final mystery. Who the, and pardon my Disney-esque French, yuck was Jenny? Well, at first, Jenny, played by Jessie Ness, seems to be a recovering alcoholic who is trying to charm her way into Cassie's life. When that does not work, she hits closer to home. More specifically, Cassie's brother Davey, played by T.R. Knight. She tries to rope Davey into becoming a guest of her podcast, but when Davey realizes Jenny's only using him to get to Cassie, he backs away. Not the best decision, considering half of the second season finale is dedicated to revealing Jenny as Buckley's boyfriend? Kind of? Apparently, after looking up Cassie's ventures, Jenny strangely grew empathetic for Buckley, Then she immediately contacted him, traveled to the prison he was being held at, and the two had devised a plan to take down Cassie. In my mind, I was repeating one singular word. What? No, seriously. What? Are you telling me the show forced down its own throat another twist / mystery to swallow? But after doing some research, I discovered that it was Kaylee Cuoco's decision to not only bring back Buckley, but have Jenny be revealed as his psychotic admirer. Like, I am all for going back to basic stories, like Flash with season 4, with like the mix of comedy and drama, and what else? I guess Buffy with like season 5, and then there's like, you know, remakes and whatnot, and reboots of sitcoms and like classical movies. That's all right. Halloween, How I Met Your Father, etc. But to not even have half an hour dedicated is frustratingly confusing. If anything, it seemed like the cast and crew knew they were most likely not getting renewed for a third season and just wanted to do as much as they could with the time they had. Which is actually a shame because I would have loved the third season. But alas, it's time yet again to change the execution. Since the first season introduced an organization of assassins, with Miranda and Buckley being our technical guide, I think the third season could have dove deeper into that. As for the second season finale, maybe some North Korean government agents managed to break Buckley out and then assigned him the mission of eliminating Megan and her family, but he instead decided to go after Cassie, and then with the help of Jenny, the two managed to kidnap Cassie's closest friends and family members. Then Cassie's forced to make the decision of who's the first to die, but thankfully another friend of Cassie's, Shane, played by Griffin Matthews, who was revealed to be a CIA agent in the season 1 finale, ambushes Buckley and Jenny with an army of geared up CIA agents. The ending scene has Cassie, her family, and friends gathered around a large picnic table in her backyard. She gives a touching speech implying reconciliation with everyone, and they all start to eat. As a sweet, homely montage plays, Cassie's interrupted by a text. It's a pre-recorded video message from Buckley and Jenny. It was time to be sent exactly then, and Cassie listens to it as the two explain their other devious plan. Apparently, Buckley and Jenny only used a gun to pump up the thematic levels of their hostage takeover. So prior to this, I would have showed a scene where, you know, Buckley and Jenny sent a video message of their hostage takeover to Cassie. And then, in actuality, Buckley and Jenny already knew they could not count on Cassie to make the tough call. So, in the twist, what do? They poison a few of Cassie's family and or friends. Who exactly, I couldn't really pin down on, since most of them are enjoyable or really, really intriguing. So, that could be left up to the writers to decide if I, you know, gave them inspiration. But Cassie is left shockingly horrified as she begins to tremble and hears coughing in the distance. The camera zooms into Cassie's left eye and reveals, and though this could be seen as more comedic rather than serious, I want to think it's more kind of like dark humor, leaning towards that. Cassie's left eye reveals a reflection of Cassie's dual personality, party girl Cassie, waving with an evil grin, hinting that Cassie has yet to conquer her inner demons. Which are kind of like the alcoholic / troublemaking sides of her. We can hear faintly Engelbert, and oh my god, is this a hard name to pronounce. We can hear faintly Engelbert Humperdinck's rendition of the song Blowing Bubbles. To anyone who hasn't heard that song before, and now that I just think about it, this will be another reference to that movie. It could be heard during an action scene in the recent movie Bullet Train. For those who also may not recognize the name, he's the guy who sings that TikTok's famous song, Lonely as a Man Without Love. You know, the one that MCU's original series Moon Knight repopularized earlier this year, which has a character that also deals with dual personalities because of PTSD. You know, I think if I think too deeply about this, next thing I know, I'm going to be digging myself into an eternal rabbit hole. But what do you flight attendant fans think? Or any of you admirers think? Should Cassie have conquered her inner demons earlier in the season or leave it as a cliffhanger? Should Jenny have been a part of the second season or saved for the third? As I previously mentioned, you can express your thoughts through my Instagram, again, at denny.pivac. Spelled Pivac, but pronounced Pivac. I know, confusing. Anywho, now we go on to a personal favorite movie of mine that holds quite a lot of nostalgia, but still has its quirks. 1985's Young Sherlock Holmes, also known as Young Sherlock Holmes and the Pyramid of Fear. I first became a fan of Sherlock Holmes after watching Warner Bros. 2009 adaptation starring Robert Downey Jr. as the titular title character. My mom eventually told me during her childhood that she was also obsessed with Sherlock. She then noticed my growing obsession and bought me a copy of Great Illustrated Classics adaptation of Sherlock Holmes' classic mysteries. From the Red-Headed League to the Speckled Man, I cannot help but go on to exploring more media. Sooner than later, I stumbled upon a DVD copy of Young Sherlock Holmes at a pharmacy. I bought it, watched it, and then watched it again. I was obsessed even more, not just by Nicholas Rowe's portrayal of Sherlock and the unexpectedly astounding CG effects of the cathedral glass knight, but there was just one thing. One thing that I could not understand is the connection the movie made between Sherlock's past, present, and future. Now, I know it seems strange, but even before MCU movies, post-credit scenes were still pretty popular to sprinkle around, you know, movies. And this post-credit scene particularly confused me, frustrated me, I don't know, a mix of both. Anyways, the post-credit scene reveals the villain of the movie, Professor Wraith, played by Anthony Higgins, who, fun fact, also played a version of Sherlock Holmes in CBS's TV special 1994 Baker Street. But Wraith assumed the identity of Professor Moriarty, or Moriarty. Similarly to how I reacted to Jenny being Buckley's secret lover, what? There are so many reasons why this does not work as a twist nor a sequel bait. Number one, in Young Sherlock Holmes, the name Wraith is revealed to be an anagram for Wraith's true name, Egyptian name, mind you, Etar. You know, Wraith spelled backwards. I can understand if the creators want to be more diverse or inclusive and change the ethnicity of Moriarty, which is why a more culturally appropriate casting choice would have been Egyptian actor Omar Sharif, famously known for playing the role of Sharif Ali in Lawrence of Arabia, not Anthony Higgins, who is a white English actor. Reason number two why this twist doesn't work, much like the first season of Only Murders, I do understand the creators trying to have every little thing be connected and seemingly come full circle. However, they do realize it destroys the direct continuity that much of the past literature from Sherlock Holmes has built upon for nearly a century, right? I mean, if their goal is not to be faithful, but to create an entirely new timeline or universe for Sherlock, they succeeded. And honestly, I'm not being sarcastic. I really enjoyed the movie. I love it. However, if their goal is to connect this story with countless others created prior, this definitely throws a whole fandom off. Reason number three, this twist/sequel bait did not make a lot of sense. In most of the stories, Sherlock and Moriarty are around the same age. They don't fight like master and apprentice, but like brotherly equals. It's surprising for Sherlock to be outwitted by his exact opposite, as it was probably the same for Moriarty and for us, the audience, too. But now, the movie made it no longer intriguing or surprising because Moriarty is decades older than Holmes in this iteration. Moriarty has much more experience, knowledge, and resources than Sherlock would be able to acquire in the next couple of years. The literal phrase, like taking candy from a baby, could never be placed more fittingly than in this movie. Also, now that I think about it, Moriarty was Sherlock's nemesis because he wanted to prove he was better than him. For a while, Moriarty believed he was the smartest person alive, and that everyone else was just inferior to him. When Sherlock came along, he decided to play with him like a toy. He would literally switch gears, pluck at strings, and sometimes wind Sherlock up. In Young Sherlock Holmes, Moriarty's trying to get revenge on those who desecrated his homeland's sacred areas. He even creates a cult to entice those with useful resources and whatnot to benefit himself. To know now that Sherlock is rather an interference in Moriarty's grand scheme than a worthy opponent is just frustratingly confusing. Though one could also say the reveal of Professor Raid slash Moriarty is not a mystery, but rather a cliffhanger, I believe it is an odd blend of both. For the mystery of who Moriarty was, or truly is, was technically revealed in the movie, but at the same time, it did not need to be. It didn't need to be. I mean, like, why? However, much like the past stories I looked over, that does not mean I did not enjoy seeing them. I'm intrigued by them equally, quirks and all. But, alas, I also ask you, the fans, do you agree, disagree? Do you think Professor Raith should have been revealed to be Moriarty? Do you think Sherlock Holmes is a crucially underrated movie? Yet again, I say you can express your thoughts through my Instagram at denny.pivak. Now, we dive into our fourth and final analysis of this episode. It's yet another film, which also just so happens to be my second favorite movie of all time, just behind the Indiana Jones quadrilogy. And yes, I understand that doesn't make a whole lot of sense considering quadrilogy refers to four installments, but I cannot really choose because to me, they are all entertaining. Like, I love each and every one of them. I consider them one whole big movie, whole long movie. And that second favorite movie of mine is called Knives Out, 2019's Knives Out, to be some more specific. Written, directed, and produced by Rian Johnson, the same guy who directed that unofficial remake of Empire Strikes Back and that time-traveling movie that inspired one too many jokes, Knives Out was an entertaining romp from start to finish. From Daniel Craig's obnoxiously stereotypical southern accent to Ana de Armas' character having, as Craig's character put it, a regurgitative reaction to mistruthin'. I cannot help but watch the film every year. However, one day, as I was scrolling the internet, and God knows I shouldn't have been, I noticed a couple of videos that happened to nitpick Knives Out. Now, normally, I hate watching nitpick videos because the more I see, the more I realize why my liking for a movie isn't valid, and I just don't like that. Because I'm a film studies major, and I study film for God's sakes. It's not called anti-film studies. Each and every film has a unique aspect that I think should be visualized at least once. Unfortunately, I was full of myself, more so of Rian Johnson, and thought, how could someone hate on Knives Out? Well, I watched the videos and realized, oh yeah, there's not really a murder as there are multiple mysteries. Yet again, it's recapping time. Daniel Craig's character, social media famous detective Benoit Blanc, is hired to investigate the death of Christopher Plummer's character, mystery author Harlan Thrombey. Mystery as in the genre, not mystery as in he's a ghostwriter, no one knows of his works. Actually, he's actually one of the most popular mystery writers of all time. Considered to be on the same level as James Patterson and Agatha Christie, Marlon has written quite a lot of books. So many so that he and his family have become filthy rich because of it. However, when he discovers that the family has grown increasingly greedier, he decides to change his original will. Someone manages to find out about it and decides to kill Harlan for it. At first, it is suspected Ana de Armas' character, Marta, is the killer. The reason being because on the night of Harlan's 85th birthday, Harlan wanted to get a little loopy, and Marta decided to give him some morphine. Though I previously mentioned I did not wish to gush over too many of the actors and actresses I mentioned, I again cannot help but gush over the chemistry that Marta and Harlan have. It's like an unusually perfect blend of like grandfather to daughter, friend to friend, and or like master to apprentice. Because it's like, at the same time, Marta teaches Harlan as much as Harlan teaches Marta about each other's lives. You know, they learn more, they adapt, they grow closer, and like, Ana de Armas is just so charmingly and likably cute as Marta, and like Christopher Plummer is just so reminiscently and comedically sweet. He reminds me a little bit of both my grandfathers, rest in peace. Anyways, Marta injects Harlan, but then realizes she mixed up the medications and gave Harlan an unbelievably large amount of morphine. Maybe not unbelievably, but just a little bit over the edge. Marta believes she's to blame for Harlan's death, but is later revealed she's not the killer. The true culprit is actually revealed to be Chris Evans' character, Harlan's grandson, Ransom. Man, that is a tongue twister. Try saying that three times. Like, literally try saying that three times fast. Harlan's grandson, Ransom. Harlan's grandson, Ransom. Harlan's Nope, I'm already tongue twisted. See, never mind. However, Ransom did not technically kill Harlan. Ransom's original plan was just to switch the stickers of the medication bottle and the morphine bottle, and also steal the antidote. However, Marta had given Harlan his medication so many times over the past few years, she remembers instinctively the correct bottle. So, how did Harlan actually die? Well, after he devised a plan to set Marta guilty free of his death, he decided to make his death look, again, for lack of a less harsher word, self-inflicted. Though tragic, a hand-drawn self-portrait of Harlan that Marta discovers near the end of the film freakishly turns his frown upside down. I mean, literally, this painting, when it's first shown in the beginning of the movie, it's a frown, and then magically, it's a smile. And I guess it's symbolizing that he can now be at peace and all affairs are in order. It's later revealed that Harlan gave everything he owns to Marta, his company, house, etc., and Benoit Blanc drives into the sunset preparing to set sail for the upcoming sequel, Glass Onion. Though it's primarily going to be on Netflix, the company did decide to release it for one whole single week in select theaters. Coincidentally, it's the same week as Thanksgiving, and one thing I will definitely be thankful for is scoring a ticket for a screening for all 7 days. That's right, I plan to see this movie as many times as possible because I am a Koff. Spelled K-O-F-F, meaning Knives Out fan forever. Because I cannot tell you how much I'm obsessed with this movie and its upcoming stories and sequels. Now, as for the other mysteries and shows and movies we talked about, they're all connected by, like I said, mentioned previously, a singular trend. That is, each of them has a second mystery. That's not to say that every time someone introduces a second mystery, it's not interesting. A second mystery can be interesting. If anything, a second mystery can provide surprising twists and turns and whatnot. And essentially, that's what some and most creators try to go for. But most of the time, to add a second story when your main focus is already being advertised and like excused, I don't know what the proper word is, like exclusive, you know, it's like the thing that we have to focus on and everything else can just be forgotten about. It does make a whole lot of sense because you don't want to drive away attention. Like one primary example, which I mentioned previously, the flight attendant, that was like the one second mystery that or twist that I really did not need. And then also for Young Sherlock Holmes, even though I freaking love the movie, the twist that Wraith was actually Moriarty or that Wraith became Moriarty was just weird. And actually, speaking of Moriarty, there is actually a character in Young Sherlock Holmes who actually I presumed was a young Moriarty. In the movie, there's a character named Dudley who is a classmate of Sherlock Holmes. So Sherlock and Dudley and Watson and a bunch of other boys, they go to this private school, you know, four boys, and it's like very prestigious and whatnot. But once in a while, Dudley will make a mystery, like a little game for Sherlock to solve. And I thought to myself, wait, he makes games for Sherlock to play? Isn't that Moriarty's whole MO? And I thought to myself, oh my god, is Dudley going to be revealed to be Moriarty? But no, it's Wraith. And like, that was kind of weird because I thought, wouldn't it make more sense because not only the age difference, but also, I mean, not actually age difference, the age similarity between Dudley and Sherlock, but also at the same time, their connection. Because, I mean, even though Professor Wraith did have a connection with Sherlock, it makes more sense why Sherlock and Dudley have, in a manner of speaking, tighter connection because they hate each other's guts. Dudley wants to prove that Sherlock is not the smartest, and at the same time, Sherlock needs to prove that he's the smartest man in the world. But, you know, I digress yet again. And then for Knives Out, of course, I mean, there is a death that happens, but it's not essentially a murder, which is strange because by most of the advertising for the movie, and I guess also a read-through of the synopsis, you would think it is a murder mystery, but it's not. And at the same time, it's not like the second mystery or the mystery itself was boring in another way. I mean, like, the show, the movie, not the show, I mean, I guess the show, what it, like, you know, showed, what it expressed was really intriguing, you know, with all the characters, the twists, the turns, and whatnot. And, like, a lot of the characters were likable. Like, I can tell you how many times I either laughed, burst out, giddy, or, like, whatnot. Like, I just love that movie. But at the same time, the more and more you analyze something, the deeper and deeper you get, and you realize that it's not really kind of the main point or what you thought. Because when you have a murder mystery, but there's really no murder, and at the same time it's not technically a mystery, that's just kind of throws you off. Because then after you realize that, after you know that in your mind, when you're watching the movie again, you know, in the near future, you're like, yeah, but why, you know? And then for Only Murders in the Building, that was a really decent show. I'm not going to say, actually, it's like one of my all-time favorite shows, but I got to say that it really improved during its second season, because I think it went completely balls off the walls crazy. Like, it, like, not to dive into so much recap and, you know, spoilers, of course, for anyone who has not yet seen the second season. In the second season, it's revealed that Charles is somehow strangely connected to the murder, and at the same time, the victim of the crime. So, in the second season, I think it's the second or third episode, I forgot exactly which one, it's revealed that Charles' father had an affair with both a famous painter and Bunny's mother. And Bunny's a character in the series who is, I believe, much older than Charles, and she is the landlord of the Arconia. And she's not really, she's seemingly the, supposed to be the unlikable character, like the stick in the mud to, you know, the protagonists. But in one episode, it's revealed she was actually wasn't all that bad. You know, she was nice to those who she liked, and she was mean to those she didn't. So, you know, she was okay. But the weird thing is, they really went overboard, like, oh my God, there's this famous painting with Charles's father in it, and it could be connected with all these other characters, and, like, oh man, like, we're trying to, you know, connect these dots. And it's not to say it was not, like, you know, surprising. It was, but they went really jumping the shark on connecting each and every, you know, little thing. And then plus, there's a new character introduced into the second season who is seemingly and coincidentally a big fan of art. And a few days before Bunny died, that was the victim or the dead body that Mabel was leaning over, the tease for the second season I referred to, that was a painting that she was obsessed with. And I'm like, so you're telling me that there's a famous collector of art who's obsessed with particular paintings, and at some point she was obsessed, or she knew about the painting that Bunny had, which was Charles's father and some other woman making love. And I thought to myself, okay, well, that's kind of odd, because, like, wouldn't it make more sense that she is the villain? Because, like, you know, she direly needs, you know, like, art, you know, to, like, I don't know, fulfill her, like, purpose or whatnot. Like, maybe she just needs it so badly, I don't know. Or maybe she could, like, you know, sell it for money. Maybe she needs it for, I don't know, some, I don't know, like, what could I think of? Like, maybe drug money? I don't know, something obscure, something, you know, all of a sudden. But no, it's revealed to be, like I said before, Poppy, who is the assistant to the podcaster, at least in the series, who's known as famous podcaster, Cinda Kenny. And, well, that's, I think that's about, enough, analyzing. Guys, thank you so much to, anyone or everyone who stuck around this long to, listen to me, ramble on about, shows and analyzing and theorizing and, fandomizing and whatnot. And, tune in next week where we talk about some more movies and more shows. I'm your host, Denny Pioch, and Only Murders in the Writer's Room has just begun.